supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. In the next few days, President Obama and his wife Michelle will visit armed forces at Fort Bragg. They'll thank the armed forces for their service and the sacrifices they've made during their deployments in Iraq. All U.S. troops will leave Iraq by the end of this month. Newly deactivated servicemen and women will return to many things, the welcoming arms of families, friends, and neighbors. And what else? Well, those with emotional and physical challenges will need support. Even those who transition from combat to home front effortlessly may find it hard to find work and are sure to face new routines that were established at home in their absence. So what can you and I do in the name of compassion to welcome home our troops, to give them a sense of place in our society, to help them feel understood, to let them know that what they have done is important, to lead them to the tools they might need to stay grounded and whole and reclaim their rightful place here? These are but a few of the questions we'll tackle today with my guests. Here in the studio is Lieutenant Sam Consul. Lieutenant Consul is a former Pennsylvania Guard officer and Army combatant engineer. He's written Service and Sacrifice, Memories of Operation Iraqi Freedom, with a Veterans Mental Health and Resource Guide. He joins us here in the studio. Sam, welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Gottlieb, for having me on the show.
Is Sam okay? You prefer Lieutenant Consul?
Sam's great.
I'm not going to call you Sam unless you call me Dan.
All right, Dan.
Deal. Okay. And joining me by phone is Lori Moss. She's a social worker. She manages the Philadelphia VA Medical Center's Returning Combat Veterans Program. Lori, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Dan. It's really a pleasure to be here with you today.
And we'd love to hear from you or our listeners. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Sam, you served in Iraq from December 2004 till November 2005. You were with the Pennsylvania National Guard. When you enlisted, did you expect to go to war?
At some point in my life, I did foresee that.
What was your vision of war?
You can imagine shooting. You can imagine chasing and trying to find an elusive enemy of some kind to come into contact with them and destroy them, actually, if you're trained properly and to complete the work, you're given to do.
Why did you sign up?
I had friends who were in the military, and I was looking for that kind of structure coming out of high school. I knew that when I saw them, they were clean-cut, clearly objective-oriented people, and that's where I wanted to go.
The idea of war didn't dissuade you.
Well, I know I didn't look at it as a job back then. I looked at the training that was available, for one thing, to complement college and the opportunity to be such a vital part of some group, some small team or a company. And that was December 13th, 1984, when I joined the Marine Corps Reserves at first.
Wow.
So it was a while ago.
So you had this vision of what war was like. What was it like?
Mostly what I knew of it was what I saw in movies about Vietnam. I was a history buff to an extent, so what I saw of trench warfare in World War II So my vision of it would be, you know, I thought of walking around in a combat zone armed, looking again for an enemy.
You, our knowledge, Sam, is basically the same as yours was before you went to war. You know, the vision that we get from newsreels and books and movies. Tell us, you're a writer, you can describe things well. Take us there. Tell us what it was like for you when you were there on the ground.
We were prepared better than I think anybody before or even since because of the months of training we spent at Fort Bliss, Texas, and at Fort Polk, Louisiana. We were in the vehicles we were going to be driving. We had the same weapons and team going into it. But until you land at your final forward operating base or where you are on the ground in that particular combat zone, it's a stark contrast to just about anything you might have imagined. It's immediately impactful as far as the first thing I saw at the base where I landed was a Abrams tank being dragged along because it had hit a mine. As soon as I got off the helicopter, it was dragged by, so I knew that I was in trouble.
What was it like?
It was extremely cold. Folks, I have a picture in my book. Folks imagine, you know, a place like Iraq in the desert to be right. 138 degrees, and it was eventually, but in December of 2004, it was about 41 degrees, and there was frost, and it was extremely cold with a chopper rotor wash coming down our backs. It was chilling. It was chilling to have a platoon of men standing behind me, and we were ready to walk forward.
Chilling.
Absolutely chilling.
Take us further inside, Sam. Inside of you, tell us what it was like to be you in that moment.
I've never been so tuned in to what I was meant to do in my life before or after. The only more natural thing that I can imagine is in a personal relationship, like being a father, that I'm a father of three, or in a very, very, very close, in tight family experience with your children. So being with my men that long, I had a platoon of 27 combat engineers, and I knew them down to the hobby, the habit, the children. And that's who I was going to serve with, and that's who we were going to face an enemy with. So it narrows down to this in tight, trusted loop. All I had was three squad leaders and a platoon sergeant, and they disseminated my orders that I received from higher. So it narrowed. Every step we made into combat narrowed us down by one bag, by one lighter piece of equipment, down to one vehicle and one what they call fire team.
Give us a feel for Iraq. Is it fair to even ask that question? Is it like asking, give us a feel for America?
No, I think the folks in America, you can't, from video, from television, from news, you can't imagine driving through a village with open sewers, with hundreds of children wanting to approach you and ask you the questions that are at the forefront of their minds. You know, who are you? Where are you from? Why are you here? And to be able to, you know, just navigate a very small village of less than 1,000 people who need some service, a school or a water system that the combat engineers are supposed to be there to do, not just look for improvised explosive devices, you know. This going house to house at 1 a.m. looking for the bad guy is the most intense experience that I know Marines and infantry do more than I did, but to do it even once is the intensity is unimaginable.
How so?
Well, you're in every movie you've ever seen. I mean, I saw Saving Private Ryan, and I imagined what it was like in a trench, looking up at that one moment, like we did at Paris Island. You would look up from the firing line, fire around, and then get back down. I said, keep your head down. There's a time when you're outside of the Humvee, and there is no place to keep your head down. You're fully exposed to the environment, fully immersed in it, in that one house with your team of maybe 4 to 6 people.
Sam, many years ago, I interviewed a Vietnam vet here who had very severe PTSD. To look at him, he looked like he was still in the bunker.
Yes.
And he said that when he landed in Saigon it was almost as though a videotape started to play inside his head, and his body was just going through the motions, and this videotape was playing. It's the whole experience was surreal, and now it keeps playing back now that he's
playing. Yeah, I brought a digital camera in there, and I was hoping to journal and record this experience, but if I told you it was burned, I mean it is burned into my memory in color. Someone sometime told me you don't dream in color, and by gosh, you do. I absolutely dream in color, you know, sometimes daily about this experience, and it is as accurate of a dream. Very few pieces are falling off 6 years after I'm home.
What are the emotions as you dream?
If it's a flashback during the day, it's a question of, did I do that one thing right that I'm thinking of or remembering? Questioning my judgment, questioning what happened and what came out of that moment. But if it's a night dream, I'm experiencing 6 years into it, I'm experiencing sort of a, they call it a mashup. It's a mashup of the Vietnam movies that I saw and World War One, World War Two movies and my experience now. I've become disconnected from my patrol. I'm somewhere alone on a roof in Iraq trying to find my way back to my base.
Let's bring Lori in. Lori, what are the themes of the dreams you're hearing from these returning vets?
Well, hi, Dan. It's not unusual to hear exactly what Sam is talking about, especially that feeling of trying to reconnect with their troops, feeling a little bit lost, or that something has happened to someone. Even though that person might be okay today, this event didn't really happen, but that something traumatic has happened to them. They're trying to save them. They can't get to them. And sometimes, believe it or not, the dreams are about other people who were not there in the combat zone with them, family members. Again, that feeling of trying to take care of them, save them, make sure that they're okay. I hear that a fair amount.
Sometimes we have dreams. They're an effort to help us heal something inside, help us understand it and come to grips with it. And sometimes dreams are just repeats of anxiety-based experiences. What's your take on these dreams, Lori?
I think both of those things, and definitely the anxiety. So, you know, when people are coming back from a combat zone and really trying to readjust to being back home where they're no longer at that level of fear or lack of safety, they second guess themselves, like, was I okay? Did I do the right things?
Sam, how are you doing right now?
My mind was wandering, and I was thinking of some events.
You were back.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw you took a deep sigh, and I could see you weren't here anymore.
I have a friend who's in Afghanistan right now. He's been there 1 month, and I just got a Facebook post from him, one Facebook post, that he's on the grounds up in the mountains of Afghanistan, and I have no idea how he's doing. Right now, I have no idea how he's doing.
Yeah. And I can see the emotion I'm seeing is fear.
For his life.
Yeah, yeah. Sam, you recited the 91st Psalm every day before you went to combat. It's also known as the Soldier's Psalm. Are you okay reading it? I know you're feeling
emotional. I'd be honored to. I mean, my faith-based relationship helped me in combat, and it wasn't the thing for everybody, but it was for me. Okay. So there's got to be something that grounds you in your personality from home and who you were when you got there, and this was based from my father, Sam, to me. And so, yes, I'm comfortable.
Mind reading it?
Okay. Psalm 91. He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will rest in the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in whom I trust. Surely he will save you from the fowler's snare and from the deadly pestilence. He will cover you in his feathers, and under his wings you will find refuge. His faithfulness will be your shield and rampart. You will not fear the terror of night, nor the arrows that fly by day, nor the pestilence that stalks in darkness, nor the plague that destroys at midday. 1,000 may fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, but it will not come near you. You will only observe with your eyes and see the punishment of the wicked. If you make the Most High your dwelling, even the Lord, who is my refuge, no harm shall befall you, no disaster will come near your tent. For he will command his angels concerning you to guard you in all your ways. They will lift you up in their hands so you'll not strike your foot against the stone. You'll tread upon the lion and the cobra. You'll trample the great lion and the serpent. Because he loves me, says the Lord, I will rescue him. I will protect him, for he acknowledges my name. He'll call upon me, and I will answer him. I'll be with him in trouble. I'll deliver him and honor him, and with long life I'll satisfy him and show him my salvation.
What did that do for you?
Well, driving outside of the wire, leaving the relative safety of our base, where we were rocketed and mortared every day, but it was just a moment, a grounding moment in my faith that no matter what happened, good or bad, in the mission, that I was in the right place in my mind.
Sam, as I read it, it really is about war, this psalm, and facing an enemy. It promises safety and salvation in return for faith and devotion. That's the same theme through many of the psalms. Did it do that for you?
And it's really the safety of the soul. And I, my body, as I wrote in the book, I did different things to mitigate the danger. I put a leg up, or I would turn a certain way, or I'd put have my bulletproof vest on. But what the prayer for me was to ensure the safety of my soul in case I was killed, that my soul and my trust was in the right place and that my family would be cared for.
So it gave you that well-being, that kind of spiritual sense.
Spiritual sense of well-being. So yeah. You're not always just trying to protect your body. The armor, the other stuff is there to do that. This is a protection layer that for my soul and my mind.
That voice is Sam Consol. He's a former Pennsylvania Guard officer and an Army combat engineer. He's written Service and Sacrifice, and he joins us here in the studio to talk about the experience of war and hopefully guide us through what we can do to help the transition of all of our returning vets coming back this month. I'm also joined on the phone by Lori Moss. She's a social worker, manages the Philadelphia VA Medical Center's Returning Combat Veterans Program. We're going to take a short break. After we come back from our break, we will take your calls. Our number is 888-477-9499. We'd love to hear from you if you are a vet, know a vet, or love a vet. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, Elizabeth Bennett and Associates, providing personalized and discreet divorce and family law services through litigation, mediation, collaboration, and negotiation. Located in Wayne, PA. Online at ebennettlaw.com.
What's right and left about New Jersey politics? WHYY presents Rate the State, a political midterm review, Thursday, December 15th at noon at the Princeton Public Library. Garden State bloggers from BlueJersey.com and SaveJersey.com break down Governor Christie's term and the past 2 years of New Jersey politics with WHYY's Eugene Son moderating. December 15th at the Princeton Public Library. To RSVP, visit whyy.org/member experience.
WHYY programming is supported by the teachers and education support professionals of the Pennsylvania State Education Association, educating all children for a bright future. We are PSEA, providing the power of a great education.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about what we can do to understand, to care for, to make the transition easier for all the many returning vets who are going to be coming back this month. We're talking with combat veteran Sam Consol and social worker with the VA, Lori Moss. And we'll be talking with you in just a few minutes. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888 877-977-9499. Sam, you sustained an injury when an IED blast knocked you unconscious. And you describe, I think it was in the book or some other writings, that you have a mild traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress disorder. What do you mean by a mild traumatic brain injury?
Well, and not having shrapnel penetrate my body, it gives immediate illusion that you're not injured. And the night that I was hit with the strongest IED, I was hit with several IEDs, but one hit next to the door of a truck I was in caused what I was diagnosed not until 2009 as a MTBI, or moderate, actually. That's what the term, I think, the VA uses is. It's still considered, I think, a severe concussion. And the symptoms of that weren't treated when I was in combat. Again, they weren't discovered and began to mitigate or treat them until 2009. It's just like a concussion, as pressing in the news as any of the sports players. Peter Crosby of the Pittsburgh Penguins has experienced, and even the Flyers captain right now, some symptoms of it. So if you're thrown off your kilter, that's it. It's a bang.
What remaining symptoms do you have?
I have some with, you know, balance issues. I think what the TBI does to my life is it exacerbates the post-traumatic stress. It is short-term memory loss is probably one of the most frustrating things you can experience. I can't put anything down of any importance and remember where it is even 5 minutes later. So every symptom that comes with a TBI, however severe, is probably related to memory loss and some change in what functionality you had before, analytical or otherwise.
So tell me about the post-traumatic stress disorder. Would you call that mild, moderate, or severe?
It's been severe for me. It's been debilitating, and it caused me to use all of the time, sick time I accumulated at my previous job, to spend at the VA. So whereas a lot of the people that worked in my old employment at Philadelphia Airport banked 60 to 100 sick days, I used every one of them up. I wasn't sleeping. I wasn't able to concentrate at work and complete tasks, and I thought it not responsible to be there. I needed to go to the VA and get treatment and try and, again, mitigate it in some way. So it's life-changing immediately, and it changes, like, what you thought you were capable of doing, you're no longer capable of doing.
You told me during the break, Sam, that you knew Lori Moss. Is that where you guys met?
I met Laurie at the VA, and Laurie can kick in a little bit. That we've done Theater of War together, which is a program for presenting the plays of Sophocles and the Greek Trojan Wars, and we've met, and I've called her for help with different programs, the Greater Philadelphia Veterans Network, and some of the things that we're both involved in. We show up at the same places, right, Laurie?
Absolutely, and I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to say hi to you earlier. It's nice to be with you again, Sam.
Yes.
Lori, I want to talk to you about PTSD. What are we learning about that? I read a couple of years ago where they're actually treating PTSD out in the field now, in the battlefield.
You know, I think they are doing a little bit of that, but it's very, I think, very short-term, intense. I mean, what we're doing here at the VA is using more evidence-based therapies, prolonged exposure therapies, cognitive-based therapy, cognitive processing therapy, and they are a little bit intense up front, but they do, as I said, they're evidence-based treatments, and they are really helping people. And medications, of course, are used in conjunction with that, not for everyone, but sometimes to sort of help tamp down the intensity. You know, Sam was talking earlier about that strong focus that he had when he was in the combat zone, you know, so he really had to be paying attention all the time to everything that's going on, which is perfectly normal. That's what we want people to do, what we need people to do when they're in a combat zone. But obviously when they come home, we want to help to teach them how to sort of bring that down a couple notches. And some of the things that we do actually, we talk about training, we talk about learning new skills, because that does really help to then give them new ways of dealing with those kinds of problems, or as Sam said, or you said, to mitigate the symptoms.
Sam, you've had these therapies. I saw you do a thumbs up there.
My VA counselor was, this was her first time through prolonged exposure therapy, was with me. So she's been doing that regularly since then, and it's a 15-week, hour-long recorded session of your worst case scenario that you experienced. And so I had to, and this is where the writing genesis is, that I started writing down those hour-long sessions. I started, so we'd go through this attack that I described, and I'd take that audio recording home, and I would transcribe it. And next thing I knew, I had four or five chapters of what I started to envision as a book.
Hmm. So essentially, the therapy is about looking at your nightmare and learning to tolerate that.
And tolerate it. And that's, so if you experience it over and over again, in vivo, they call it, and you're in the moment and close your eyes the whole time, and then after you are at home this long and you can talk about it in such detail, it seems to be like your fifth thunderstorm, you know. At that point, you know what to expect from a thunderstorm.
So once you've spent some time in hell, little hot weather doesn't bother you that much.
And so if you, there's some training that comes out of it, like sleep therapy that I've been through. It's just a matter of making it part of your life, and that's probably where I believe I've failed, is that some of these sessions I've gone through, and I've been told there's no follow-up to them. There's, you know, you get through that program or a sleep study or something like that, and they teach you how to breathe and relax, but you just get wrapped back up into life and diapers and jobs and driving in intense traffic, and you just don't breathe.
Social worker Moss, we need some follow-up and consistency. Is that on the radar there?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think that it is really important to remember that there is no cure for PTSD. So it does require ongoing maintenance, just as, you know, some medical conditions might require ongoing maintenance. You know, so if someone was diabetic, we wouldn't say, well, we got your blood sugar under control, see you later. You know, what we say is we still need to continue to manage that. So the programs exist. I think that what Sam has said, though, is true for many people. There's a really strong desire to go back to living a, you know, normal life and being part of society and connecting with family and friends. That desire is there, as much as sometimes it's difficult to do that. And I think not everyone wants to sort of stay in treatment for long periods of time. And we will see people who will come in, they will do intensive treatment, and then they will leave for a while, and then they'll come back when something else happens. I think much like, you know, typical for many kinds of problems.
You know, one of the reasons 12-step programs work so well is because they're not treatment per se. They're, you know, kindred spirits coming together to share stories of hope. And there's a lot of research now, Lori, about what happens when kindred spirits come together to even to practice things like these breathing meditative exercises, or, you know, to give tips to one another. I wonder if those kind of programs exist in the VA.
In some ways, yes, but more limited than we might want them to be. I definitely agree with you that there's so much benefit in having people be able to come together when they're like-minded. We have vet centers that are really for our combat veterans to come in and do therapy, talk therapy. Not always in a group environment, and not always in a peer-led environment. So there, I agree with you, Dan. There's lots of room to expand on that.
Yeah, and it's pretty cheap, if I can just push you a little further on this. I want to bring somebody into the conversation. We have on the phone Ed Anfendor. I hope I pronounced that name somewhat correctly. He also knows Sam. They're working on a project together. Ed, do we have you?
I'm here. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
I want to bring up the question I brought up in the very beginning of the show and what I really want to emphasize today. And that is, what is it that you need? You're a returning combat vet?
Yes, I was actually injured at the World Trade Center right after the attacks. My unit responded to the World Trade Center on 9/11. I was injured at World Trade September 26, 2001. But to your question, what do we need when we come home? Understanding has been one of the issues I know I've gone through, and I can also speak for Sam because we've talked about this numerous times. Understanding, the programs are out there. The VA's been very good to me, but what's really helped me propel myself in healing has been Wounded Warrior Project, specifically Project Odyssey, which I attended. Now, Project Odyssey, if I may, is about a week long, and it brings those kindred spirits back together of men, and well, mostly men at this time, but they have women retreats that are just like you, that are suffering from combat PTSD, and that really changed my life.
Wait a minute. Let me slow you down a little bit, Ed. It's called Project Odyssey.
Correct.
And how does one find it?
Okay, yeah, you can actually find it through Wounded Warrior Project. You can go to woundedwarriorproject.org, and once you get involved with the project, submit your application, get involved, you'll receive a packet, an alumni packet. And in that packet has a program directory, and it'll actually tell you about Project Odyssey and how to apply for Project Odyssey. And so far, it's been phenomenal. They've had an incredible turnaround. Now, with Project Odyssey, they actually have a VA counselor on staff. So they usually take about 14 people. They'll fly you to, for instance, I went to Arizona. We went to the Grand Canyon. And they took 14 of us, put us together, and really let us just talk amongst ourselves and talk things out. That really propelled healing. We had a wonderful time. We also let you see things you've never seen before in your life, such as we went to the north rim of the Grand Canyon. Mm. It was just an absolutely wonderful time, and it really, really changed my life. They also have other programs, such as Adaptive Sports Foundation, which is in Windham, New York, and they actually help us, those of us that have been injured, to find new ways to get out and just do different things, water skiing, hiking, and just show you that even though you have disabilities, even though you have post-traumatic stress disorder, you can live your life and you can move on.
I want to ask you, Ed, and Sam, you also. I had an interesting experience when I was preparing this interview that I was hesitant to ask Sam about the details of what happened over there for fear of, I don't know, triggering you and
yes,
upsetting you. On the other hand, if you were in my office, I would have no problem. I would kind of be embracing you, psychological,
right,
and I'd
right
want to hear more. So I want to hear from both you guys. What is it that you want when you encounter someone? Start with you, Sam.
Well, Ed and I, have known each other a few months now and had to tread very light water. We were at the Trade Center at the same time. He was under orders and I was a volunteer and didn't know each other there, didn't see each other there.
Wow.
So for me to take over a period of, say, 3 weeks, and Ed will follow up on this, of knowing him to finally ask him to share a few details and not to do that on the phone, waited for a meeting where we were at lunch and finally said, "Ed, this is where I was at Trinity Plaza. What did you see? And can you tell me how you were injured? And how did you do that, Ed? Remember?"
I felt very comfortable at that point. I know, especially for other veterans in our situations, you get to know the person. But if I'm meeting someone on the outside, I'll get a lot of questions like, right away, what did you do? What did you see? Did you see dead people? Did you see, what was your job? But with Sam, I can speak, I believe, for both of us that we were comfortable. There's that you understand each other when you first meet. And I felt comfortable, but it took a few weeks, and I didn't ask Sam anything about his tour until we actually met, and we both became very comfortable. There's just that kindred spirit of understanding each other.
Why is that? Why the wait?
I don't think that you want, the pain that I know for me personally that you suffer with every day from the things that you've seen. Trying to readjust to normal life, the weight that you carry, especially with physical injuries, and you really don't want to project that on another veteran. So when you finally get comfortable with each other, right. I think it's just the right time to do it. I know within the Wounded Warrior Project, and even at the VA, most veterans that I talk to, we never ask each other what we've seen. I think you see it in each other's eyes, to be very honest. You feel it in their soul. So, I don't think it's my right to really ask anybody what they've seen. If they want to tell me, we build the friendship, and then we start to speak about it.
Yeah, it's interesting. As I listened to you both, I think what I really wanted to know was what it's like on the inside, having had that experience and having lived with it, for X number of months or years. But what's it like on the inside? And I guess you guys don't have to wonder because you know what it's like inside yourself and the other person. So what comes after that is the details, and the details might be secondary.
I think the
I would have to agree with that. I mean, some of us, and I'm speaking for myself, I was in a very dark place for a very long time, and that walk that you've had to lead, and you just details are secondary, especially when you see someone that's just hurting the same way you are.
Well, here's
we've
got to take a break. Ed, can you stay with us?
I can.
All right, and that's Ed Anfendor, and he's going to stay with us. We're going to continue talking with Lieutenant Sam Consol. He's a former Pennsylvania Guard officer. He's a military combatant, and he's written Service and Sacrifice. I'm also joined by Lori Moss. She's a social worker with the VA. She manages their medical center's Returning Combat Veterans Program. When we come back to all three of you and to our listeners, I want to hear what I can do, what you need from me and from every one of our listeners. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Holidays are a time of happiness and joy, but can be difficult for those who suffer from depression, mood swings, or bipolar disorder. The Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit at Penn Medicine is researching better treatment for bipolar disorder, depression, and anxiety. You may be eligible for a research study of the effects of medications or natural supplements to treat these symptoms. Initial evaluations determine eligibility for participation. 215-662-3462, 215-662-3462.
Her distinctive style of dress has fashion critics raving and women all over the world following her lead, but she is not a runway model or celebrity entertainer. She's the First Lady of the United States.
Mrs. Obama masters style with distinction, simply put.
In her new book, Commander in Chic, fashionista Mickey Taylor says, "Don't hate, emulate." She'll tell you how next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about returning vets, what they need, what happens to them, and what we can do to help them make this transition better for them. My guests are Lori Moss, social worker with the VA, Sam Consol. He's here in the studio. He's a returning vet. I'm also joined on the phone with Ed Anfendor. He's also a returning vet and apparently a buddy of Sam's. Sam, I want to talk about when you came home.
Okay.
Not only did you come from an unfathomable experience to where you once lived, but you were a lieutenant, like you said, and you were the boss of everything.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to bring the main body home of our engineer company, which was over 80 soldiers. And in engineering, they're all men, so it's not the paradigm of experience is the active duty folks go home to their base. The families all live on the base, et cetera. In the National Guard, we landed at McGuire Air Force Base, which is adjacent to Fort Dix. We were bused to Fort Dix, where all of the other units we served with had their family members waiting for them, but ours were not there. Because I was ordered by my company commander to keep absolute silence on that military secret. When we were going to land back in the United States is a risk. It's you're told not to share troop movements, things like that. So I followed orders, and sometimes I guess to the letter of the law. And there were no families. My wife was at work, and I had to borrow a cell phone to call her from a gymnasium at Fort Dix that I was going to be at 34th and Sansom, and dropped off. And that's that day.
What was that like for you?
Going into the gymnasium and seeing banners and children when I had children, and to see people running to families, and to see the people that I was leading back looking at me with eyes of fury. Where's my family? You know, I kept them silent, and I must have had so much of their trust that they didn't talk to any of these other guys we were on the same plane with, because all these other families were there waiting and we weren't. And it was an abrupt and abrasive experience that isn't common. This is 2005, and yellow ribbon programs exist now and things like that. But for us, there was some kind of mistake made, and I take responsibility for it, and I can never give it back to those enlisted troops. And
Lori,
yes.
Who made that mistake? Or was it a mistake?
Well, I think what Sam's talking about, the whole idea of secrecy in a mission, is part of what keeps people safe. So the idea of continuing that on, we even see it after people get home, actually, of that they're afraid to sometimes talk about things that did happen, because that message is so clearly ingrained in them by the Department of Defense. They say, we can't talk about that. Things have certainly changed since then. Sam just mentioned the Yellow Ribbon programs that the Department of Defense has set up to ensure that there's a much smoother transition as people come home. But in the 2004-2005 timeframe, I think there was a lot that people were perhaps taking for granted on that side, and didn't make that big effort to reunite the service members in any branch with their family members when they came home. That's
somebody,
very sad that happened that way.
Somebody dropped the ball, but it wasn't Sam Consul.
It certainly was not.
Sam?
Well, there was another, sometimes you related to a command failure, but my unit, Charlie 103rd Engineers, did not have a family support group.
Yeah.
It was made very clear from our commander that he was not going to be involved in setting up a family support group, that it wasn't within the means of his family to do it, and that he expected if it was going to happen, others were going to have to lead.
Well,
that never happened. My wife Dawn had no contact from anyone during my deployment from the unit, not a single, how are you doing?
Well, let's go to the phones. We've had people waiting to talk with us for a long time. We've got Lois on the line. Lois?
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I'd like to thank you and thank all veterans out there, and I'd like to share. I had recently had a unique experience talking with a Vietnam vet and a friend of mine who's a Gulf War vet, and the similarities between their experiences, not only from combat but also trying to transition back into life, are very similar. So it was fascinating to me to see the generational similarities in the generations of veterans trying to transition back into civilian life. Another thing that I'd like to ask if you could touch on, which I think a lot of people that are combat vets have experienced, is hypervigilance that they have when they come back, and how that influences their transition.
Lois,
I think a lot of families don't understand that, and that the families need to try to understand. I think people want them to come back and be the same, and they just it's almost impossible for someone to go through some, you know, traumatic experience and be the same. And if the families could just not give up and keep supporting them and really try to understand what they're going through.
Oh, Lois, I'm so glad you called. Thank you. We're gonna follow that up with Sam. Thanks for your call. Do you have hypervigilance?
I've defined it in my book. I've researched it, and I'm very proactive in my care, as the Philadelphia VA has been very, very proactive in my care. And you're always on. That's the word. And you're on, and the startle reflex is there, and it's not just a closing of the car door, if you can imagine. You take every little task at work so seriously. Like, it's got life or death consequences. Like, you know, not just photocopying something, but, you know, where I worked, there were runways that were opened or closed. And to see any form of inaction to complete a mission at your civilian job, you know, was unacceptable in combat. And that caused a lot of problems for me, being hypervigilant and always on and erratic.
How was your family?
How is my family now?
Well, how were they then? How are they now? And I also want to know about your neighbors.
You know, I lived in Philadelphia. Well, we moved. When I came home, there was a good welcome home party at the house. There was. My welcome home was based on my church. And the priest who married my wife, Dawn, and I, and my wife had a lot of folks from my family there at the house to meet us. So once we were released from our orders 2 weeks after we came home, they were prepared to greet me. So that was done, you know, quite well and welcoming. But my wife and my, especially my daughter, my teenage daughter, Amanda, absolutely hate the Army and how it was handled and have nothing that they want to do with it.
And yet you want your 18-year-old son to join.
Well, I think, you know, when we just talked about it in the last day, you know, he could really use the structure of the Coast Guard or something. He doesn't have to go in the Army. There's, you know, he's good at certain things. My son's a Civil War reenactor, and I've tried to do that with him, just to end up being sick on the Civil War battlefield. I can't play that role anymore, and I clearly understand that now. But if military service ends up being right for him, I wouldn't stand in the way of it.
What can we do? I want to hear from all three of you. What can we do? What do you need from your neighbor, your person in the street? Sam, you start.
Well, actually, Dan, you've used this word right from your first email back to me, is this need for understanding. And I don't just want folks to read my book, because there's, you know, telling stories is a great tradition going back to all ages in Indian culture. I mean, you know, like American Indians and sitting around a campfire. So for people to ask the right question at the right moment, or to not ask any question and just talk about what we used to do, play ice hockey, do what we used to do, and not have to feel walking on glass. Everybody walks around me as if they're stepping on glass and afraid that I might go off. Just,
and what's that like for you?
Well, it's impregnable. It's just, you know, everybody, you know, is a fear that they'll start this conversation that I won't be able to stop for an hour or two.
Yeah.
You're going to start me talking about Iraq.
It's impregnable, which suggests to me that it makes you feel more alone, more isolated.
Alone is a word that I, you know, relate to on many fronts, is that you know that there's 2+ million returning combat veterans that have had the same experience, but you, in this culture, in this society, and at the job, and then you get back home, you still have that.
Lori, do you want to weigh in on what we can do to help?
I absolutely do. I think first and foremost, it is so important to do exactly what Sam just said, kind of allowing people to direct what they want to talk about, and follow their lead a little bit. We have to reach out to them. I mean, this is a community issue, you know, where we have to be able to say to people, hey, how are you? And thank you for your service. And I know sometimes that feels trite, and I think even the veterans that I talk to, sometimes they're unsure why someone is thanking them for their service. But I think that at the very minimum, we need to let people know that we appreciate that they have gone off and sacrificed, that they've taken time away from their families, their jobs, and gone over there and done something which is really threatening to their whole way of being, not just their life. So I think we need to acknowledge that. I think we need to be able to listen to them and hear what they have to tell us. And understanding, as Ed said, you know, that there is really kind of a trust issue. People aren't going to tell us things right away. So we need to allow them to be comfortable with that and let them know that we don't know what happened to them. It's not the same as, you know, well, I went to the grocery store today and I got stuck in line. Well, that doesn't have anything to do with
right.
how someone else is feeling. So we really need to be compassionate and empathic.
It's unknown, and in many respects, it's unknowable to
yeah.
those of us who haven't been there. Ed, we've only got a minute left. Could you also give us some guidance about what we can do?
I really think it's just treating us like a normal person. Like Sam said, you know, you really don't want anybody to step on eggshells and walk around you like you're different. We know that we're different in our own ways. And we just want to be treated normal. That's it. That's all I can say.
Yeah, so it seems to me that what I'm hearing is one of the themes is that you left our culture as you've known it, as we know it, and you've engaged in an experience that, like I said, is unknowable by anyone but you guys and women. And you come back to this culture, and yeah, there's a difference. You are different, and sometimes that difference causes suffering. Sometimes it doesn't, but there's a lot we can do to welcome you back in every sense of the word, welcome you back to this culture that you're very much a part of. And I really appreciate all three of you, all of your guidance and wisdom, and I will certainly take my education from you very seriously that I got today. So thanks all three of you for joining us.
My pleasure.
You're welcome.
We've been talking about how we can welcome back our support soldiers who are coming back from Iraq. My guests have been Lieutenant Sam Consul and Lori Moss. I was also joined by Ed, who's also a returning vet. Next week, we're going to be talking about greed in light of the holidays, what it is and how it affects us. You can reach us at voices@whyy.org, and I am at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our volunteer. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.